Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm your host, Lydia Johnson. This week, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin joins me on the show. Plus, Mitchell Hora with Continuum Ag joins us to discuss his testimony on 45Z, and Megan Boutwell with Stillwater Associates provides an update on California's low-carbon fuel standard. But to begin, many row crop farmers are concerned about having access to a wide array of crop protection tools. I asked EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin what his agency is doing to ensure new active ingredients are being reviewed and approved on a timely basis.
So we inherited a massive backlog, over 14,500 of a backlog inside of our pesticide review. That backlog now has gone down several thousand since then. We're looking more in the 8,000 range as opposed to over 14,500. It's been primarily two things that we've incorporated. One is we added full-time employees. We've added personnel, added scientists to that office. So we increased bandwidth from that standpoint. And then we also have been investing in IT, improving the software, the ability to be able to do that aspect of the function, increase bandwidth from that standpoint. And collectively, it's allowed us to massively reduce this backlog. And we're just going to continue to blaze through it, applying the best available science, being transparent with the public on that science, being able to communicate, and also be very active throughout the country. In my first 9.5 months as administrator, I went to all 50 states. I met with a lot of farmers. And I think that's been real key, is to bring the agency to real world America, to the farms, to the state farm bureaus, and also to be able to hear all the very diverse feedback and perspective so that when I come back to DC, I'm armed with that in making the right decisions and getting this stuff done as fast as possible.
I'd like to talk about the Make America Healthy Again movement. You know, many involved with that would like to see pesticides and particularly glyphosate eliminated entirely. You know, how are you balancing the concerns of farmers with those in the MAHA movement that have been so supportive of this Trump administration?
Actually, it's quite simple for us at EPA. It's about following the science. We want gold standard science, best available science. Right now, we are in the middle of doing a review on glyphosate. I have met frequently with our dedicated career scientists who are working on this issue. Many long meetings where, you know, we're going through their work. And I've made it very clear to them that I do not want to bias their research. I do not want to tell them. I don't want to prejudge for them where I want their results to end up at the end of the review. I actually want to empower them to just be able to do their job, to be able to review the science, to do it fully, and for us to be totally transparent with the public.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after this.
As a cooperative, our customers are our owners. They share our profits and help guide our business. We're not just another lender. We're Farm Credit, and we're here for you.
I think some of sustainability to farmers just comes second nature. If you
yes.
asked a farmer, are you sustainable, they'd probably look at you maybe a little funny and say, I don't think I'm doing anything that special, but it really is just what they do. We're all farmers, and our goal is taking the best care of our land, our cattle, our natural resources.
This
is my sustainability story.
The ag industry celebrated the historic renewable volume obligation set earlier this year, although there's been speculation that the half-RIN rule could be delayed or never implemented. I asked EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin what tangible economic impacts he expects for farmers, processors, and rural communities over the next several years, and his outlook on the next RVOs.
Well, for one, we've signaled and we are planning on moving forward with the discounted RIN that you just referenced with the foreign imports. So that's something that we're looking to implement starting in 2028. As soon as RFS Set 2 was done, announced, We immediately moved to the work on RFS set 3. One of the biggest challenges was inheriting a many year backlog of what accumulated up to 175 small refinery exemption requests. That backlog was cleared. That very much helps with our work, our bandwidth. We've received more small refinery exemption requests since last summer, but it's nothing like the 175 application backlog that that we were dealing with this time last year. Also, now we have a formula that has been utilized, that is public, that is known. So there's consistency and predictability as we go towards RFS set 3. And the last point I think also helps is that, you know, while the 2024 deadline was blown for this RFS set 2 that we just put out, it is so much easier now at this point for us to not only be able to get RFS set 3 done urgently, but to have this back onto a timeline where the community throughout the country is going to be able to look towards future deadlines and be able to expect to be able to demand that that deadline is going to get met. While all this is going on, of course, Congress is debating statutory changes. We will follow whatever federal statute says. If Congress passes new legislation that makes any changes here on this front, then we'll follow that guidance. In the meantime, though, as far as predictability, the way that we pursued RFS Set 2 is the way that we're looking at approaching RFS Set 3 as well.
Yeah. And big picture on RFS, I mean, do you believe that it works as it should right now, or does it need a better look and some adjustment from Congress?
Well, I've been involved in a lot of conversations with Congress where I've shared ideas. Our agency provides technical assistance. This has largely been a debate within Congress that has very different views, different visions. The votes and the coalitions are on different alignments. It's not necessarily a red versus blue issue entirely. I've had conversations with two Republicans on the phone where those two Republicans had a difference of opinion. So, it's good to let that legislative process work its will for me as the EPA administrator to provide my feedback, my perspective, my lessons learned. But my point to them and my point to the American public, I want to be very clear, I will follow whatever the law says. And I think that that's very important because for too long, you had heads of federal agencies that were getting too creative and saying, regardless of what the federal law says, I'm going to take my own creative interpretation of it. I'm going to utilize Chevron deference. I am going to say that if this law doesn't say I can't, well, I guess that means that I can. But post Loperbright, now that the Supreme Court has weighed in, they've gotten rid of Chevron deference, I'm going to follow the best reading of the law, whatever that law says.
And Administrator, you're on D15. It's been a big topic. Moved through the House, now awaits action in the Senate. President Donald Trump has said that he will sign it if it reaches his desk. But, you know, what is EPA doing and what are you doing in your role to actively engage on Capitol Hill as this now sits in the Senate?
Well, I just had four hearings in front of Congress over the course of the last few weeks where this topic came up at multiple hearings. This topic also came up when I was at my congressional hearings last year. And just like I was explaining my answers last year, I similarly did the same this year when the topic came up, talking about how much of my time is spent interacting with Congress, where members of Congress have to spend so much of their bandwidth advocating to the EPA administrator for that next ask, that next signature, that next approval on E15, whether it's waivers that are coming in from 8 state governors, or it's a waiver for the summer, which we have to sign off on. I have to sign off on every 20 days as we're going through the summer, depending on the conditions at that particular time when we're signing off on the waiver. It's really a process that is year round. So for Congress to legislate on this topic is going to not just increase my bandwidth as EPA administrator, and I'm fine here. I have a great team, and you know, I'll spend all day every day focused on all of the work that the federal statute requires. But I have to say, for members of Congress, I'm sure that all of these senators and congressmen who spend a lot of their energy contacting me and meeting with me to discuss that next ask on E15, I'm sure they would like that time where they can focus on all sorts of other issues that are important to their constituents.
We'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Honecke looks at U.S. meat consumption trends and this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Memorial Day marks the start of outdoor grilling season, and new data shows Americans are expected to eat more meat this year compared to the past 7 years. This chart shows the total consumption of beef, pork, and chicken from 2019 through USDA's projections for this year and next. Americans are expected to eat more than 42 million pounds of chicken, nearly 30 million pounds of beef, and more than 21 million pounds of pork this year. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper from our brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put 4 kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
For 35 years, soybean farmers have invested together to build demand for U.S. soy at home and around the world. Through the Soy Checkoff, farmers turn every dollar into stronger markets for U.S. soybeans, driving innovation and partnerships across feed, food, fuel, sustainable production, and beyond, led by farmers and built to last. U.S. Soy, 35 years of delivering value back to the farm and investing in the future of agriculture.
Welcome back. Mitchell Hora with Continuum Ag testified before the Treasury Department and Internal Revenue Service on proposed regulations for the 45Z Clean Fuel Production Tax Credit. We asked him about his message during the hearing.
Yeah, it's kind of beaten the same drum that I've been beating on this for quite a long time now, which is get farmers a seat at the table in this 45Z program and specifically make sure that the feedstock calculator is good and robust, and we're advocating that it be very much in line with the current Department of Energy feedstock calculator, which does quite well, rewards a wide array of cover crops, and provides ample CI reduction for farmer practices. So a good calculator, like DOE's, that's number one. Second, integrate farmers via a book and claim system, so don't disrupt the physical grain supply chains, and instead allow farmers to sell their verified CI certificates independently via a book and claim system. That would increase scale and traceability and cut down on some of the additional cost of a mass balance approach. And then third, maintain the ISO 14065 audit protocols that the USDA has already done a pretty good job of delving into. And Continuum Ag actually went forward and did a trial run and verified 30 million bushels under the standard. It was farms from across 12 states, very diverse array of farms. We've already proven that these ISO standards are good, they're robust, and they're workable for farmers. So good calculator, book and claim, rigorous, but yet just audits. And we're ready to rock and roll at scale.
Yeah, and you've done, an excellent job promoting 45Z and those benefits all across, the Corn Belt where you call home and hear you on podcasts all the time. But, how much of a boon could this really be for farm country? Why should farmers really be falling in it? And could it be the difference between staying in business and going out of business, the benefits of this?
Yeah, it's a huge opportunity. And the average value that we are seeing, again, waiting on some final rules, but the total shareable value, which number one goes to the biofuel producers and then a portion of it could go to the farmers, we're seeing an average of potentially $1 a bushel in, or a little bit more. It's actually about $1.08 a bushel is what our current data is showing. And that'll be shared, amongst different folks. There's been quote put out by Growth Energy, one of the leading biofuel advocacy groups and trade organizations, They said that they anticipate 45Z increasing family farm top line by 10 to 15%. So absolutely a big time opportunity here. And especially at a time where farmers really could use all the help we can get. But what I love about 45Z is it is rewarding farmer outcomes as they are implementing good regenerative practices like cover crops, reducing tillage, better fertilizer management, and it encourages productivity and yield. So I love that. And basically enabling farmers to utilize their holistic farm data to create value in the supply chain. So it's keeping that value and that sustainability outcome associated to a farmer's production. It just makes sense.
Yeah. And you're a farmer, you've done a lot of work on, you know, boots on the ground, but what does it look like for that average farmer producer to implement? I mean, this is something they can jump right into.
Yeah. So what I love about it is family farms like mine that have been using no-till since 1978 and cover crops since 2013, we don't qualify for some of the other existing carbon credit programs because we've already been doing the practices, but we do qualify for 45Z because it's based on the farmer outcome versus a default. So early adopters can participate. Also, newer adopters could be incentivized to change practices. This, again, could be some significant financial opportunity that would warrant maybe going ahead and doing those cover crops or maybe going ahead and switching over to strip till instead of conventional till or you know, just taking another look at your fertility management system or using manure, a wide array of different things. And you don't have to do full-blown no-till and a, you know, 4 foot tall cover crop. You don't have to do that. You can choose what's best for your operation.
We'll be back with more Newsmakers right after the break.
I've worked at Coca-Cola for 21 years.
We're delivering Dr. Pepper for my brand new facility in Dallas, Texas.
We're really proud to still make Pepsi products in America.
You don't need a college degree to work here, but I put 4 kids through college by working here.
This is a great place to work with great people and great American brands.
Grocery stores, convenience stores, restaurants, they all depend on us.
We deliver great paying jobs.
We deliver beverages people love.
We deliver for our community.
America never stops. Thanks to the financial support of Farm Credit, neither do the farmers and ranchers who call her home. Since the beginning, we've been helping rural America show the world what hard work can achieve. But the job is far from over. And as rural America grows further, we'll be there.
Welcome back. Biofuel policy dynamics are shifting as some states continue to push for aggressive decarbonization, while federal policy has become far less predictable. Megan Boutwell with Stillwater Associates provides an update on the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard and why it's so important for farmers to be aware of.
The California Low Carbon Fuel Standard is the oldest low carbon fuel standard out of all of the states. They set the trend. The standard requires reducing carbon intensity in the liquid fuel pool or in the fuel pool, transportation fuel pool, at a declining rate until going out into the future. And so the reason agricultural products are important for that is because the easiest way to decarbonize the current transportation fleet is by using drop-in fuels like renewable diesel. So you can replace petroleum diesel in the transportation fleet, in the diesel transportation fleet with renewable diesel, which is produced from products like soybean oil or waste products like used cooking oil or tallow. And so that product, renewable diesel, has become the marginal credit generator, which means that is the product that is reducing the most carbon intensity in the transportation fuel pool in California. At this point, a blend of renewable diesel and biodiesel has replaced up to 70, almost 75% of petroleum diesel in California. It is also the marginal credit generating fuel in the other low carbon fuel jurisdictions like Oregon and Washington. While the fleet works on transitioning to other lower carbon options like electric vehicles. This is a way to meet the requirement while the fleet is transitioning.
And how have low carbon fuel policies really changed demand for soybean oil and other ag feedstocks in California, but across those other states and areas that you mentioned as well?
Yeah. And so the way that it's changed demand is it's generated demand for processes to continue to reduce the carbon intensity of agricultural products. So not just soybean oil or canola oil, but also ethanol produced from corn products. So farmers and producers have found ways to technologically reduce the carbon intensity of their fuels by updating their farming practices to reduce carbon intensity, using production technologies that also continue to reduce carbon intensity, so that you're reducing the, and we call it CI, reducing the CI throughout the value chain of that product so that you continue to get value in the low carbon fuel standard jurisdictions.
Yeah. And we talk about RINs or those renewable identification numbers. You know, that value is very important to understand biofuel policy dynamics. You know, can you explain, those are somewhat unpredictable right now, but does that unpredictability come from policy uncertainties or what are you seeing there?
Yeah. So there has been some policy uncertainty. The EPA adopted the latest RFS set to regulations for the renewable fuel standard. And so that created a much larger target for biomass-based diesel. With that, that has pushed up RINs prices for those fuels. Part of that is that the RIN price needs to be able to make up for the price differential between producing the petroleum fuel versus producing the renewable fuel. So the delta between those is what the producers need to make up the price difference. And so there are a couple things that are going on with RINs prices. One is that, you know, we have this new RFS set to goals for biomass-based diesel that are very aggressive. And so that is supportive of prices. The other thing is, since 2025, we have lost $1 per gallon biomass-based diesel blender's tax credit that has shifted to something called the Clean Fuel Production Tax Credit, or 45Z, which is based on the emissions factors in the fuel. So it has a carbon intensity component, and it is generally less than $1. The cap is $1. And depending on how low the carbon intensity is in the fuel, you get a cent per point above 50% reduction. The market lost that $1 per gallon value, reduced it by quite a bit. And so the RIN has to make up for that loss in value from the other tax incentive.
I'll be back with more newsmakers, but first, Andrew Honecke looks at the Western U.S. streamflow forecast. And this week's Map It Out.
Rivers and streams out west are running lower than usual thanks to persistent drought and the fact that mountain snow has already melted. This map shows USDA's most recent streamflow prediction for the western part of the country. You can see that most rivers and streams are expected to see less than 50% of their usual streamflow, indicated by the reds on the map. USDA says these flows may come close to the lowest on record for the region. For AgriPulse, I'm Andrew Honecke.
Register now for the 2026 AgriPulse Food and Ag Issue Summit in California. The event will offer participants a full day of presentations and panel discussions. You can hear from members of the California Legislature, food and agriculture leaders, along with industry experts and academics. The summit takes place June 2nd in Sacramento. See the latest information and register today under the events tab at agripulse.com.
I was kind of known as the sheep guy around here. The fire went from north to south and it blew that way and it went straight down the house. Lost all of our sheep literally a week before we start lambing. and I was really in a bad place. I happened to notice this farm state of mind piece of paper. And I picked up my cell phone and I made a phone call, and that was the best phone call in my life. I'm glad that I'm still here. So don't do something permanent over a temporary situation.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Both the House and Senate are in session next week, and USDA's Crop Progress Report will be released on Monday. For AgriPulse, I'm Lydia Johnson. Thanks for watching.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more. For agriculture, trade, food, environment, and regulatory news, your source is AgriPulse.com.